I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Women's voices have been heard loud and clear this year in both politics and the workplace. Today, we'll hear from an iconic activist who's spoken out for decades and who's led the way for feminists around the world. Gloria Steinem returns to the program with her perspectives on the modern Me Too movement and her thoughts on this week's election. Then, an aging population could soon cause a shortage of primary care doctors in America, and that might challenge the future of healthcare. But could specialized nurses be poised to step in and fill the gap? We'll learn more about nurse practitioners whose ranks are growing. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. '92 was deemed the year of the woman when four were voted into the Senate and the number of women in the House went from 30 to 48. In 2006, 148 women went to Congress. So far, Tuesday's election hasn't quite reached that number, but it did result in 96 seats in the House for women and 12 in the Senate. An additional 9 women won gubernatorial races. Now, a conversation with Gloria Steinem about progress made and progress deferred. We'll ask the iconic figure of the women's movement her thoughts on Tuesday's elections, the battles women still face, and what message she would most like to deliver to girls and young women today. Gloria Steinem will be in town Saturday for an event for Planned Parenthood. More on that in just a few minutes. But first, Gloria Steinem, who joins us via Skype from her home in New York City. And Gloria, welcome back to Up to Date. It's so nice to have you again.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you.
How big a step forward did women take on Tuesday with the midterm elections?
You know, it's hard to measure because it's a gradual, long process. But I would say this was more a leap than a step, because clearly this was the first time in my lifetime that to be a woman, and especially and also to be a woman of color, was more of an advantage in the elections, at least in the House and in other state level elections, governor and so on, than to be a white guy. I mean, that's the first in my life.
I was going to say, is that really the first time? Because maybe in some previous years, that might have been an advantage as well.
But not in the same numbers and not with the same diversity.
Yeah.
To have two Native American women, for instance, is a big step forward, because after all, this country was founded on the tragedy and the elimination of, you know, I don't mean to depress us at this hour, but it was the biggest genocide in the world still.
Of course.
Of the many very advanced Native American nations, which actually were more advanced in medicine and technology and government. I mean, our constitution was copied from the Iroquois Confederacy than the Europeans were. So it's really heartening to see that is beginning to be remedied.
Well, one of those two women was Charisse Davids, who was elected right here from the Kansas City suburbs on the Kansas side of the state line. How big a deal is that?
I think it's pretty big, because if it weren't pretty big, it would have happened before. But at the same time, you have voter suppression of Native Americans, for instance, in North Dakota, where suddenly at the last minute, they were expected to have a street address, despite the fact that living on reservations means they don't have a street address. So it was a very obvious voter suppression.
What advice would you give to someone like Charisse Davids as she heads off to Congress in a few weeks?
I'm not here to give her advice. I'm just here to say I want to listen and support you. I mean, it's the fact of her experience already makes her knowledgeable in areas in which I am not. But if she thinks I can help her, I'm here.
You know, Gloria, I'm still struck by the fact that we have obviously 435 seats in the U.S. House. And yet, in the wake of Tuesday's election, 96 women will serve in the House. I mean, that's still a long way from 50%. Should we be frustrated in 2018 looking at those numbers?
Yes, we should be frustrated. The only advantage of being as old as I am is that I remember when it was worse, so I have hope. I remember when the only way a woman could get into high political office, into Congress, was to be married to a man who had that job. He died, and then you might have a chance to take over his seat for a while. That seemed to be a path to power that was very hard on men, to put it mildly. And so, but that shows you how far we have come. And of course, I remember working for Shirley Chisholm, who was the first African-American woman, and who was a great hero because she also ran, albeit symbolic, but still a presidential campaign. So she single-handedly took the white male-only sign off the White House door.
So why is this taking so long?
It's taking so long because patriarchy, though it is a relatively new political system in human history, because after all, humans have been around for a very long time. And on this continent or subcontinent, it's only maybe 600 years old because it only came with the arrival of Europeans. But patriarchy says that men control reproduction. And since that means controlling women's bodies, that has always been the first step in a hierarchy that is embedded further by racism, since you also have to, in the long run, control reproduction in order to keep racial groups separate. So it has been deep and enshrouded with the mythology of gender. As far as I know, Cherokee and most of the Native American languages didn't even have he and she. They didn't have gendered pronouns. It was the introduction of gender and the idea of race, there was no word for race either, by the European arrivals that created the first step in this hierarchy that we are now trying to humanize and dismantle.
I'm visiting with Gloria Steinem. How would this country be different if half the members of Congress were women?
We do know, even as it is, even with the lower political participation of women, we do know that there is, not for all women or all men, but there is a difference in voting pattern. Women are more likely to vote for expenditures on health, education, welfare, and men are more likely to vote for expenditures that have to do with the military, foreign policy, things that involve force. So it's not to say that we don't need both, but it's to say that we've only had one so far, or at least one has been emphasized so far, and we clearly need both. Also, I do think that though there are exceptions, for the most part, women are better at cooperation. Our model of authority is the family. And you don't expel somebody from the family. You learn to get along with differences and cooperate. The men's model of behavior is the military or the corporate sphere, in which you do simply eject people rather than cooperate.
Gloria Steinem will be the keynote speaker at the event, a benefit for Planned Parenthood Great Plains, at 7 Saturday evening at the Uptown Theater. For tickets, go to partyforpp.org, partyforplannedparenthood.org. Again, it's partyforpp.org. Donald Trump, Gloria, what do you make of his presidency? What do you make of how he's handled and treated women in his administration?
Well, remember that I come from New York, where 90% of people voted against Trump because we know him. the main reason people gave outside of New York for voting for him was that he was a successful businessman and therefore would be able to run the country. We in New York know that he was a failure as a businessman. It's been figured out that even if he invested at the going rate his inheritance, he would be richer than he is now. The real estate people here would not deal with him. The banks would not deal with him, which is how he got in trouble with Russia and Saudi Arabia, because only foreign banks would deal with him. he is incompetent, and he also is a bully. It's interesting to me that his wife has chosen bullying as her emphasis. I think I understand why.
And yet he seems to have a grip on the American psyche, particularly out here in my part of the country. What do you make of that?
You know, it's up to each person to say that. I want to attribute motives, but I think it is mostly a discomfort or a opposition to change. After all, it's been a very long time that this country has supposed that if you're white, it gives you certain rights, and if you're a male, it gives you certain rights, and that hierarchy is the proper social organization. And for people who have been raised in that, it's not their fault. They didn't invent it, but they've been raised with those suppositions. And it no doubt seems very scary to see that in the first generation that is majority babies of color has already been born, and that very shortly this will no longer be a majority white country. Also, the old idea of masculine and feminine, I'm sure that it is understandably frightening. And he stands for the third of the country that opposes the changes that have now become majority changes.
Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court and the fight there was seen as a factor in Claire McCaskill's loss for the U.S. Senate seat here in Missouri on Tuesday. What did you make of that fight and the accusations of sexual assault leveled against him by Christine Blasey Ford that, of course, dated back to Kavanaugh's high school days?
Well, first of all, remember that Kavanaugh was nowhere on the first list of preferred and possible Supreme Court nominees. It was somebody quite down the list who was picked because of his views on executive power being protected rather than challenged by the Supreme Court. Secondly, whether or not you believe the sexual harassment charges against him, which I do because I listen to all the testimony, but even if you don't believe it, he had a meltdown on national television that was, in a woman, would have been called hysterical. Mm-hmm. And you know, blamed a plot of the Clintons. And I mean, he literally melted down on television. He does not have a judicial temperament. So on many grounds, he does not deserve to be there. But I have one rock bottom comfort, which is that, as Martin Luther King said, if laws are unjust, we have a duty to disobey them.
And that suggests what?
Well, that suggests, for instance, if there were to be an outlawing of women's right to make decisions over our own bodies, we just wouldn't obey it. The truth is that when abortion was illegal, one in three women had an abortion. Now it's one in four because there is more access to contraception. But it was one in three even when it was illegal. And of course, with much greater danger to women. I'm not at all diminishing the extreme danger to women's health and safety and welfare that such a law would bring back. But I'm just saying that we never obeyed it and never will.
You know, any number of women have written in on my Facebook page. I put a post up last night saying you were going to be on the show, and I asked them for questions. I got a bunch of good ones. Melissa Robinson, who's on our school board here, wanted to know, what would you say to Claire McCaskill over coffee today?
I wouldn't say anything. I would listen. I would listen and say, you know, how can I support you and be helpful?
Cindy Hodel asked, Missouri's where the ERA died, thanks to Phyllis Schlafly. What will it take now to get it passed, and how much of a priority is it still for you today?
It's a big priority for women to be equal under the Constitution. It would affect almost every area of our lives. But it's important, if we're going to pass it, it's important to remember that it wasn't Phyllis Schlafly or women who defeated it. True, some women were against it, but the majority of women always supported it. The forces that defeated it were the insurance industry, because, and incidentally, insurance has the greatest influence in state legislatures because it's the last big industry to be regulated state by state instead of federal, federally. And actually the most frequent occupation of a state legislator is insurance agent.
Huh.
So when it got to within three states, they realized that they would have to stop sex segregating their actuarial tables and it would cost them money. They had had to stop race segregating their actuarial tables. But even to this day, if you look at health plans, you'll see that probably a woman who doesn't smoke may pay a greater monthly premium than a man who does smoke because she might live longer.
Hmm.
All right. Yeah. So to stop sex segregating those actuarial tables would cost them money. And that's why the Equal Rights Amendment was defeated. Phyllis Schlafly and her group were window dressing, but they weren't the reason.
Lorraine Goodrich asked this, what is she most disappointed about in the current state of how women are treated today, and how would you change that, Gloria?
Well, it's hard to explain. What is most alarming is the violence, because the different forms of violence, from female infanticide to domestic violence, to sexualized violence in war zones here and around the world, means that for the first time that we know of, there are now fewer females on Earth than males. So that has to be the most alarming. For living women, I would say that the most difficult is the inhabiting within ourselves of the idea that we are not equal or we are not whole human beings. It's difficult for everybody who grows up in a somewhat patriarchal and racist society not to absorb those values. And it's especially tragic when you absorb them into yourself and the group in question. But it's hard not to. I mean, for instance, I once thought I should write a book called "It's Probably Only Me, But," you know, because yeah. Because we sometimes disqualify our own opinions and our own knowledge before we even say it.
Yeah, yeah. Peggy Stevenson Bear writes this really simple question for Gloria Steinem. How does she think the meaning of feminism changed from when it used to be early on to where it is now?
Well, you know, it always has been what it says in the dictionary, you know, the belief in the full equality of social, economic, political equality of males and females. So its meaning has not changed, but its perception has changed because, you know, 30 years ago or 20 years ago, even, it was seen as aggressive or even man-hating, which is quite crazy, but still people would call feminist man-haters. And I don't think that's true anymore. And there are also millions more men who call themselves feminists, because it just means we believe we're all human beings.
You know, you're at that point in your life where documentaries are being done in your life and where plays are being performed on your career. One just opened.
It's very strange, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, one just opened up in New York. It stars Christine Lottie. What is it like for you to see your life, you know, played out on stage and screen like that?
Well, what I understand is that knowledge comes from each of us telling our stories. And I learned that because after lectures or discussion when I'm traveling, talking circles go on for hours. And it's very, very important that we each tell our own story. So it's only worthwhile if my story allows other people to tell their stories. So act two of the play is not a talk back to the play. It's a talking circle. And the whole theater is arranged in a circle so that people in the audience can say whatever it is they have been reminded of or want to say because they've listened to my story, then then they share their stories. And it seems especially important now because we apparently on the average spend 11 hours a day sitting in front of a screen, which is the cause of greatly increased reports of loneliness, depression, even suicide has increased because we are communal animals and we need to be together. It's why solitary confinement is counted as torture. We're spending way too much time alone and unable to tell our stories and to learn from others. So I'm hoping that in the microcosm of this little play that is about me, that Act Two makes it worthwhile.
You know, one moment described in the play concerns, and I know you've been asked this a lot, a 1963 cab ride in which the writer Gay Talese explains to Saul Bellow as you sat between them. He said this, "You know how every year there's a pretty girl who comes to New York and pretends to be a writer? Well, Gloria is this year's pretty girl." Were you able to respond in that moment, Gloria?
No, I wasn't, because I had just interviewed Saul Bellow in Chicago for a profile. And my first thought was, oh, he'll be sorry that he gave me an interview if I'm, quote, not a writer, unquote. So, you know, my first response was a kind of culturally female response of guilt and what's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. and that's the point in the play, because it wasn't until it was over that I realized that, wait a minute, I should have objected, to this statement, but I didn't, because it's not only true that we live in a patriarchy lives in us.
Right. You know, Senator McCaskill out here in Missouri tells stories similar to this and has had a response very similar to yours. And maybe for so many women of your generation, that's sort of how things played.
Yes. So, and that's why it's very helpful to have other people support women and men, because we can see this internalization of our own subordinate position. We can see it in other people better than we can see it in ourselves. And mutual support is the way out.
You know, what are your thoughts on the fact that this country elected an African American to the White House before we've elected a woman president?
Well, there's no competition here. You know, we elect people one at a time. And, for the whole year before the election, people would say to me, are you for Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama? And I would say, yes. and then I had to choose and sequentially. So I chose Hillary Clinton because I thought she had way more experience of Washington and she was older. So, it made sense for her to go first and Obama to go second. But the other way around was also fine with me. You really have to look at each situation, mm-hmm. but I think it's important that to say that this is not a competition. This is a coalition.
Is there any doubt after the 2016 election that this country is, in fact, ready to elect a woman president?
I think there is still some doubt, yes. I mean, you could see by the degree of hatred directed at Hillary Clinton during the campaign, because the idea of masculinity is a certain amount of control or dominance or anyway not being under the authority of a woman. And I think for many men, the last time they were under female authority, they were children. So when they see an authoritative female, they feel regressed to childhood. And you can see that even in some very distinguished television commentators who I remember them saying things like, "I cross my legs whenever I see Hillary Clinton," or she reminds me of my first wife outside Ellen Road. I mean, things that made absolutely no sense when assessing a presidential candidate, but they were disclosing this deep personal sense of it's just not right for a man to be under female authority if he's an adult.
Gloria Steinem will be the keynote speaker at the event, a benefit for Planned Parenthood Great Plains. It happens at 7 o'clock Saturday evening at the Uptown Theater. Tickets, partyforpp.org. Gloria, you never disappoint. It's always great to have you here, and thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you so much, and I'm really looking forward to being there.
Sounds
thank
good.
You.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit the world of the nurse practitioner. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, the governor-elect of Kansas, Laura Kelly, will be our guest. Be sure to join us for that conversation here on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, somewhat lost in the world of healthcare between MDs and nurses is the nurse practitioner. Turns out that nurse practitioners fill a critical gap in our healthcare system and that there are more nurse practitioners than ever before, with 248,000 of them spread across the country. In advance of National Nurse Practitioner Week next week, we're going to take a look at what it takes to become a nurse practitioner and the role they're playing in filling gaps in America's healthcare. With us is Laurel Short. She's a physical medicine and rehabilitation nurse practitioner with Kansas City Bone and Joint Clinic. And Laurel, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
What is a nurse practitioner?
So a nurse practitioner is a nurse who has chosen to go back and have additional training in graduate school, either through a master's degree or even a doctoral degree, and have advanced training on assessment, diagnosis, and treatment for patient conditions.
How close do you guys get to actually having as much training as a medical doctor, as an MD?
That's a great question. So the educational pathway is just a little bit different than medical school in that to go to graduate school to be a NP, a nurse practitioner, you have to have a bachelor's of nursing first. So you already have that education. And then most NPs have also worked as nurses and have clinical experience and then go through their graduate program that includes clinical hours and classroom education.
So you guys can do some things that fully licensed doctors can do, but not everything. I'm wondering, what can't you do, Laurel?
That's also a good question. So it actually really depends on the state in which you work. So when you graduate from your program and become licensed through the state and take your certification test, that tells you all the things that we call your scope of practice. But that depending which state you work in, you may not be able to do all those things that your license and certification qualify you for. For example, it could be even something as little as I cannot sign off on home health orders in the state of Kansas. And that's just kind of a small thing that the legislation says I cannot do.
I was going to say, is there much distinction between what you can do in Kansas versus Missouri?
So, yes, there are some differences. Both Missouri and Kansas require what we call a collaborative practice agreement, which means that you need to have a physician that you have a legal document with that says, hey, if I have questions or I need someone to collaborate with, I have a specific MD that I have that relationship with. On the Missouri side, it's a little bit more what we call restrictive, to where you need to be within a certain mileage of the physician that you are working with. And there's also some restrictions on controlled substances in the state of Missouri versus the state of Kansas.
Okay. Let me go to a phone call here. Jamie Harrington from Wichita is calling. She's a nurse practitioner midwife. And I'm wondering, Jamie, first, thanks for calling. And what challenges do midwives face that other nurse practitioners may not?
Yes. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, welcome.
Today.
Yeah.
So I'm actually a certified nurse midwife and a family nurse practitioner, and I practice right now as a nurse midwife, and some of the challenges we face is because we care for women from GYN, adolescence through menopause, and we also do pregnancy. We're finding a little bit more restrictions with physicians not wanting to sign that collaborative practice agreement when we're actually doing deliveries. So a lot of us are practicing more in a nurse practitioner role in the office only, even though our board certification and scope of practice allows us to do deliveries.
I was going to say, what can't you do that doctors can do in the world that you operate in, Jamie?
So really similar to nurse practitioners, the main thing that we don't do is we obviously wouldn't do surgery on our own, although we can assist physicians in surgery. But we can write prescriptions, we have our own patients, we manage our own patients, and then we just collaborate and work with physicians if that patient has some kind of issue or complication that we need to discuss or refer to that physician.
You know, I'm wondering what the demand for midwives is today. I mean, we know that many rural places are losing obstetricians with hospital closings. So where does that leave midwives here?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Actually, in Kansas, 70% of Kansas counties don't have a maternal child health care provider.
So 70%. Wow.
Yes, it's crazy. So midwives can really step up and fill that gap in those rural areas. And maternal mortality is actually increasing, not only in Kansas, but in the United States. So we really want to give those women access to care. And midwives can do that.
Why is maternal mortality increasing, Jamie?
Well, there's a bunch of different factors that go into that, but access to care is a big thing. So those women living in rural areas of Kansas are driving an hour or two just to get to a hospital to have their babies a lot of times. Access to mental health care is a big issue. And women of color are actually dying about 3 to 4 times the rate of white women due to some disparities in health care.
Okay. That's Jamie Harrington from Wichita. Thank you for calling. I really appreciate it, Jamie.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Laurel, I want to go back to this notion of prescribing medications. Again, what limitations do you face in that whole realm of what you do?
So I primarily practice in the state of Kansas, and so I don't really have many restrictions compared to what a physician would prescribe. It more needs to be based on the area you're working in and what you feel comfortable with. So, for example, since I work in a specialty area, I'm not prescribing a lot of hypertension medications, blood pressure medications, things that a patient would get from their primary care provider. But the medications I prescribe aren't really different than the physician that I work with.
I'm just guessing that there's a lot of confusion out there when you come walking in the door. Who are you? Are you a nurse practitioner? What is that? How do you navigate that sort of uncertainty that I'm sure you face all the time?
So actually, I feel like the awareness of nurse practitioners or NPs, as sometimes we're referred to, has really improved. But I always make sure when I walk in the room that I say, you know, if you are my patient, hi, Steve, I'm Laurel. I'm the nurse practitioner who will be seeing you today. And that just makes it clear right away that the patient understands that I'm a nurse practitioner and not a physician working with them. But I've noticed a big difference since I started attending our national conference every year, you know, back in 2008 or 2009, that the public awareness of what a nurse practitioner is has really, really improved over the last decade.
I was going to say, people are starting to figure it out and they're a little more comfortable perhaps with
Absolutely.
Who you are and what you do.
Absolutely. And a lot of times I hear from patients that they love seeing both a combination of physicians and NPs, because we really focus on, we like to say, you know, we combine the care and the cure. So we really put a lot of the nursing philosophy into our visits, and we really focus on educating the patient about what the condition is and discussing treatment options and coming up with a plan together. So we really emphasize being a partner with the patients and taking a lot of time with them.
So you're hipper than MDs are. Is that what we're going to go with here?
Yeah, that's what we'll go with.
Let's just stay with that. Yeah. Do you get the respect that you think you deserve, both from the doctor side of the ledger as well as the patients?
I feel like I do. And I think especially as you're looking at the shift in how medical providers are trained, now we're seeing a shift to medical providers being trained in this multidisciplinary approach that, you know, really respecting what everyone brings to the table. And for patients to have the best outcome, we need to have a variety of types of training. And so I feel like there is a lot of mutual respect for nurses and physicians. And in the area I work in, I work with a lot of physical therapists and other members of the team as well.
How often do you ever reach a point where you have to say, hey, I'm going to have to hand your case off to a physician for whatever reason?
I think it's more that it's a frequent collaboration. So whether that's communicating just verbally with a physician or communicating with a physical therapist. So it could be as simple as having a discussion about the patient's case and, hey, this is what I'm thinking. Do you agree with this? Or it may be sometimes of, you know, we've tried what I feel comfortable with and you're not making the progress that I would like to see. So I would like you to follow up with someone else.
You know, two phrases that illustrate a major bone of contention in your profession are collaborative agreement and scope of practice. What is a collaborative agreement and who requires it here?
So a collaborative agreement is a legal document that a nurse practitioner and a physician have to say that they work together collaboratively and that the nurse practitioner cannot practice without having that physician. In 22 of 50 states do not require a collaborative agreement. So that includes states in the Midwest like Nebraska and Iowa. So nurse practitioners in states that do not require that, it doesn't mean that they don't collaborate because we do that all the time. It just means that they don't have to have that piece of paper tying them to a physician.
And what about this notion of scope of practice? That means what?
Scope of practice means being able to do everything that you have been trained and are qualified to do. So based on your training and your certification and your license, and that may include everything from what prescriptions you sign, what types of orders you sign off on. And so your training and your certification says this is what your scope of practice is, but then depending what the state legislative is, it may restrict you from that scope of practice.
Are nurse practitioners in Jefferson City and Topeka these days working to expand what you're able to do?
That's an excellent question. I'm more involved in the Kansas side because that's primarily where I practice. And yes, we are planning on introducing a bill in 2019 to hopefully move towards what we call full scope of practice.
Okay. Let me go to Mary Ann from Overland Park. Mary Ann, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, just a quick question. I think it's important for people to know the limits in terms of prescribing narcotics by nurse practitioners.
How about the narcotics question and what you're maybe prohibited from prescribing along those lines?
A great question. That also depends on the state. So my practice also has an office on the Missouri side. And if I go over there, I am more limited in what I can prescribe than on the Kansas side. So nurse practitioners need to be aware of just depending where what state they work in, it may be more limited.
Do nurse practitioners get in trouble legally because of these rules, which I'm sure you've got to stay on top of all the time here?
I mean, potentially, yes, if you do something that is not legal within the state in which you're working.
Yeah. Now, nurse practitioners can specialize in any number of areas, and I'm wondering what are some of those specializations?
That's a great question. So really, any medical specialty a nurse practitioner can work in, and I think that brings up a good point that NPs can fill a gap of primary care, which is really how the profession came about in 1965, was this idea that we had more access to care with Medicare and Medicaid, and we had more specialization of medicine. So we have NPs working primary care, but then we also have NPs working in specialty areas such as neurology or physical medicine, where the need for certain patient care in that specialty doesn't match up with the number of physicians going into that specialty.
Right.
So you have a gap. And so that's where, like in my specialty, it's worked really well that we have this team approach with a physician and an NP working together. So it's kind of a triple win, right? The patients get great quality care. It saves money for the healthcare system. And it's great for the providers because we bring different things to the table.
Well, I'm wondering, is there a big party for National Nurse Practitioner Week in the area? And can I come?
I wish there was. We just had a symposium at KU on November 2nd. And we don't have a big party planned for next week, but maybe next year, and we'll make sure you're there.
Well, come on. Let's get with it here. That's Laurel Short, again, a physical medicine and rehabilitation nurse practitioner with Kansas City Bone and Joint Clinic. Laurel, thanks for coming in and explaining all this to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.